Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this episode is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education. All patient information has been modified to protect their identity, and the views expressed in our podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinion of our employers.
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers. I am Dr. Patrick Murphy, and I am a current trauma and acute care surgery fellow in Indiana. I'm very excited for today's episode. I'm here with a rockstar team from UCSD.
Hey, Clinical Problem Solvers. My name's Anand Jagannath, coming at you from UCSD and the VA in San Diego. I'm really, really excited to be joined by my former Team 4 team members, Lizzie Hasty and Rima Deshpande. We spent two fabulous weeks together on ward service a couple months ago, and that's where the magic started, hoping to keep it going today. Lizzie, how are you doing?
I'm doing so great, Anand. Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here. I'm a second year internal medicine resident at UCSD. Rima, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, guys. So excited. So I'm Rima Deshpande. I'm a fourth year medical student at UC San Diego, interested in internal medicine, and I'm really happy to be here.
Oh, what a rock star crew we have with you all today. As a quick reminder, so we're doing a Human DX case for the audience, and we really, really encourage you to download the app and solve these daily Grumble Morning Report cases. They're a great way to get a rep in a very short amount of time. Anand, Rima, and Lizzie are blinded to tonight's case, and we'll try to solve it in real time. We encourage you to pause and reflect after each aliquot of information before you listen to their responses. As a reminder, the case creator is Dr. Patrick Murphy, and a special shout out to the editor for this case, Dr. Anand Patel. All right, Patrick, take it away.
All right, so a 39-year-old male presents to the emergency room at your hospital with approximately 1 month of intermittent abdominal pain, and it's gotten worse, which made him decide to come to the emergency room. The pain is worse with food. It radiates to the back. Only medical history is uncontrolled hypertension, for which he has been prescribed a medication. He's not sure what it is, but he is non-adherent to that medication. His social and family history are unremarkable, and he does not smoke or drink. He reports no prior use of NSAIDs and has been controlling his abdominal pain with his father's leftover oxycodone.
All right, so a lot of good information here. I'll start by kind of chatting about abdominal pain and the way that I kind of like to approach and think about abdominal pain in general. So usually when I think about abdominal pain, I kind of like to think about it based on location, and I learned it as basically being a differential built on the four different quadrants of the abdomen. So we didn't get very much information at this point regarding where in the abdomen the abdominal pain is, but there are a lot of things that can cause abdominal pain, especially with radiation to the back. Some of the key things that I would think about would be if it's epigastric, could be things like gastric ulcers. If it's kind of right up a quadrant or even epigastric, it could be things like pancreatitis. Other things that kind of cause abdominal pain and radiate to the back would be scarier things like aortic dissections, especially given his medical history of uncontrolled hypertension and non-adherence to his medication. I like that we've gotten some information on his smoking and alcohol use, and as well as NSAIDs. I assume those are given to us as kind of things to be thinking about for ulcer risk, which is nice to have that. But overall, those are kind of the biggest things that I would be thinking about at this point.
Wonderful job, Rima. I think that that's a beautiful schema. I like that as well in terms of looking at which quadrant. Hopefully we'll get that soon. I think that the timeline is really important here. It's a whole month, so that's pretty chronic from when I'm thinking about it. And I think that it kind of makes some things lower down on the list, like the acute settings, like a dissection, but it doesn't rule it out. And I think that the food relation is also really important, kind of just bringing in any hepatic, liver, biliary disease higher up on the list. And I think also what you were saying about the uncontrolled hypertension, we got to think about vascular disorders in this patient. And he's taking leftover oxycodone. I mean, that's a pretty strong medication. So this pain has got to be pretty severe.
Lizzie, Rima, this just takes me back to wards. I I could probably just go home now and have you guys just tell me about admissions over the phone, because I don't have a lot to add here. So thank you so much for that wonderful intro and discussion to this patient. So I agree with everything you guys said. I love Rima's approach to the abdominal pain, thinking about it in quadrants. As we all know from the schemas here on CP solvers and other ways we've been taught, there's a myriad of ways, but having an approach is so important. So I love that you've kind of regionalized it by quadrant. Lizzie brought in some really great points about the time course of the abdominal pain, as well as the presence of uncontrolled hypertension. Things that are standing out to me on top of that is that this is a 39-year-old man. So how many 39-year-old men have a history of uncontrolled hypertension? And it is, what we call essential hypertension is something we typically see in older adults. So that's one thing that stands out to me. The other thing about his abdominal pain that stands out to me is that this seems to be postprandial. And postprandial abdominal pain, I feel, has a different sort of schema and approach than just kind of all comers of abdominal pain. It makes me think that what happens when I eat something and when I have food that hits my stomach, why would it start to hurt? And that differential, I think about it both systematically as well in systems as well as pathophysiologically. So, you know, things that can cause postprandial abdominal pain, we could think about the right upper quadrant and all the different choles, the cholecystitis, the cholangitis, choledochlothiasis, something that's preventing bile to get into the intestinal tract. We can think about epigastric things, all the gastric pathologies you guys mentioned, as well as pancreatic pathologies. We can think also, importantly, about vascular causes, like some of you guys are saying, with uncontrolled hypertension. Does this patient have atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease due to his uncontrolled hypertension causing some sort of chronic mesenteric ischemia picture? He's also a young person, so could he have some sort of vascular inflammatory cause of mesenteric ischemia, vasculitis per se? And then we can think also about other causes of postprandial abdominal pain, like autoimmune inflammatory causes, celiac disease, inflammatory bowel diseases as well, namely Crohn's if it's going to be in the epigastric region. Again, we're going to get hopefully the location of the pain. The comments about the smoking and drinking, I'm glad that he doesn't, because that removes some things or some risk factors. But the no prior use of NSAIDs, you know, we can think about that causing afferent arterial constriction. So that can be a cause of hypertension. And I really want to highlight again, why does this patient have uncontrolled hypertension at age 39? Does he have a reason for secondary hypertension, either a endocrinologic disorder like maybe primary hyperaldo or a tumor or something? Something to think about going forward. But at this point, I love your guys' thought process and differential. I'd love to see what the next finding is.
I will expand on the history a bit just since you guys asked. He doesn't have any nausea or vomiting, and he is not obstipated. His initial vitals and physical exams are as follows. So his blood pressure is 164 over 77. His heart rate is 94, and he's sitting 93% on room air. His temperature is 37.6 degrees Celsius. His BMI is 35. On abdominal exam, really the pain is quite diffuse, but he has maximal tenderness in the epigastrium. He has no back or flank tenderness, in particular no CVA tenderness. His cardiac respiratory exam is really unremarkable. He's got a normal S1, S2, no S3, no S4, no murmurs, clear lung sounds, and the remaining physical exam is normal.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Murphy. Lots of really great information here. We confirm that he's hypertensive, and that's real hypertension. I like all of the points that you were making, Anand, about how this is kind of unusual in a 39-year-old. Temperature, 37.6. Can we get that translated?
That's a normal temperature.
Great. So that's reassuring. Heart rate, 94. That is almost tachycardic. I would say that I would think of that as pretty abnormal in a patient who is 39 years old. I think that pain alone could probably be attributed to that. And with his normal blood pressure, that is also reassuring. O2 sat of 93%. I would actually think that that's probably low. If the read is real on the monitor, I would say I would want to start thinking about, is there anything lung pathology also contributing to the situation? BMI of 35, definitely higher. And I think that that could just allude to some things going on in terms of the gallbladder, fatty liver disease, etc. And then diffuse abdominal pain, maximally tender in the epigastrium. That's really helpful information. One of the things that we've talked about on wards together is the arrow, using the diagnostic schema of an arrow going through the point through the abdomen and right through the epigastrium. There's quite a lot, you know, there's skin, there's muscle, there's stomach, there's pancreas, there are vessels, there's bone. So there's a lot of things that can be included in the differential here. Rima, what do you think?
Absolutely. I think I am in complete agreement. Kind of the main things that stood out to me were similar to what you were talking about, Lizzie. Definitely the blood pressure reflecting the hypertension. I was kind of surprised by the heart rate too, but again, could be a reflection of pain. I think of the vital signs, the thing that kind of surprised me the most is really the hypoxia. And so that would kind of pique my suspicion for maybe some sort of vascular process as well. Moving to the rest of the abdominal exam, I think it's really helpful to know that the maximal tenderness is located in the epigastrium. Again, that kind of just piques my interest vascularly about something like either some sort of malformation or some sort of like luminal disruption versus ulcers or like a pancreatic type of pathology. But it's kind of reassuring to know that the rest of the cardiac and respiratory exams are normal.
Guys, I completely agree with everything you're saying again. Yeah, so the blood pressure is abnormally high in a younger person, and the O2 set is definitely giving me pause as well. You know, if we think, we don't have a respiratory rate, but, you know, sometimes if people are in a lot of pain, they can maybe hypovent or hyperventilate, which we think should bring up the O2 set as well. But sometimes if they're taking shallow breaths, they might be effectively hypoventilating. But in this case, again, 93% is AB normal. And outside of a repeat, I'd still want to pay attention to that, you know, thinking about the pulmonary vasculature potentially as a, if there's something going on from a vascular standpoint, is it affecting more than one layer of blood vessels, not maybe in the mesentery as well as in the lungs? The abdominal pain is diffuse, and then the tenderness seems also to be diffuse, but is maximal in the epigastrium. Again, without back or flank tenderness, I'd wonder if there's any rebound or guarding, just to think about common things that can cause epigastric pain that's postprandial, like a gastric ulcer. If he has rebound at this point, it's so severe. Does he have a perforated viscus potentially? The absence of back or flank tenderness is somewhat reassuring in that I am thinking less likely that this could be a non-GR, maybe like a renal-related process where he's having, you know, a kidney stone or something. But again, I wouldn't expect necessarily postprandial abdominal pain in a patient with the nephrolithiasis. The cardiac exam, again, it's reassuring. Doesn't make me think that there's anything going on inside the heart, and the clear lung sounds is reassuring as well. But that being said, I still feel like we should be paying attention to potential vascular pathologies that could be related to his uncontrolled systemic hypertension. Any other thoughts, guys?
No, I think that those are great points. One thing that I would maybe want to do is grab an ultrasound and take a look at his belly with an ultrasound bedside. You could also look for things like aneurysm with an ultrasound as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Great point.
I told myself that I would just sit back here and enjoy the magic that's coming my way. But, you know, it's so hard not to reflect with you all just how hard it is to have diagnostic certainty about a patient with abdominal pain before you get more data beyond the H&P. You know, like, we're just speculating, and you guys' speculations are amazing. I have a whiteboard right here behind me, and I was actually hit the mute button and started taking some notes. But it's so tough to, like, be confident about what you're dealing with until well beyond the exam with abdominal pain. It's a tough complaint to get clear on with just an H&P.
Absolutely.
We'll hopefully get you some more data to work with.
Yes.
Yeah, I can give you some more data. And, you know, peritonitis is I think what you're getting at with the rebound and guarding is it can be quite hard to diagnose. And this is, you know, coming from a general surgeon. This patient did not have peritonitis on exam. So they were diffusely tender, but did not have rebound or guarding. So those are really objective findings, the involuntary muscle contraction and not voluntary muscle contraction. That's about being guarding. So the investigations revealed a mild leukocytosis with a white blood cell count of 11.3, normal hemoglobin of 11.2, sodium of 137, potassium of 4.5, a lactic acid of 2.7, which is high, creatinine of 0.91, a lipase of 120, bilirubin of 0.1, an AST of 1225, so 1225, an ALT of 1544, an alk-phos of 105, a glucose of 126, and a bicarb of 17. The patient also had an EKG done, which was a normal sinus rhythm. Viral hepatitis and PCR serologies were negative, as was other viral pathologies such as Epstein-Barr, cytomegaly, and HSV. The acetaminophen level was normal. They were able to get a right upper quadrant ultrasound that showed no intra or extrahepatic biliary dilatation.
Okay, so a lot of great information here too. I'll start with kind of chatting through some of the lab data that we've gotten. So starting with the white blood cell count of 11.3, I think reassuring that, you know, there isn't any florid necessarily infectious pathology going on, which is great, especially in conjunction with the fact that the patient is afebrile. One thing that does stand out to me is that lactic acid of 2.7. That's pretty high. I would definitely, at least in the context of things that we've been talking about right now, be concerned for some sort of like hypoxemic or hypoxic type of pathology that could be contributing to that elevated lactate. Overall, looking at the rest of the LFTs, I mean, the AST and ALT are certainly elevated. So definitely some sort of liver and potentially biliary pathology going on. I would essentially really just be concerned about some sort of ischemia or a lack of blood flow to all of those kind of organs, since it seems to be a very kind of proximally located type of ischemia by looking at these chemistries. Moving on to the EKG being normal is reassuring, and then the rest of the labs that we've gotten are also reassuring in regards to the viral serologies. And then, like we were kind of chatting about before, the ultrasound not showing any biliary dilation, I guess, is reassuring, but with the habitus of the patient is maybe not as telling as it could have been.
Excellent, Rima. That was beautiful. I think that this is so interesting. I'm so intrigued by what's going on. I think that, you know, the thing that jumps out to me right away is the AST and the ALT being elevated, like you said, Rima. And it just points to a hepatocellular pathology going on and not necessarily something going on with the biliary tract, given the pretty normal alk-phos. So the first thing that, you know, things in my brain is hepatitis, which hepatitis does this person have? And I think that, you know, we were given some information, given that the acetaminophen level was normal. I'd definitely be interested in knowing if this patient has hepatitis A acutely or any other hepatitis such as that. And then, like you mentioned, the lactic acid, that's definitely concerning. And even in the setting of a mildly low hemoglobin and the elevated white count, this patient is definitely sick. I'm worried. Anand, how can we help him?
All right. So this, I just want to say, I'm just thanking Robbie for bolding down at the bottom that the next solid quest is going to reveal the diagnosis. So after our discussion, guys, we're going to put our money down. So
great.
Let's just review really quickly before I dive into your guys' amazing commentary again, and just acknowledge what Robbie said before, that, you know, undifferentiated abdominal pain is probably one of the most challenging diagnostic problems that a clinician can encounter. And just because of how much is going on in the abdomen, how many things can mimic abdominal pain or cause, in this case specifically, postprandial abdominal pain. So just taking a look back at the initial aliquots, we have a young man, he's 39, young man with uncontrolled hypertension who's coming in with a month's history of intermittent worsening postprandial abdominal pain. And, you know, thinking about the initial schema we talked about for postprandial abdominal pain and the different buckets of disease. We're talking about hepatobiliary causes. We're talking about gastric, pancreatic causes, vascular causes, and potential autoimmune causes. You know, at this point, you know, looking at the second set of vitals, or the second aliquot rather, we have a patient who's hypertensive, who's borderline tachycardic and hypoxemic, and is obese with maximally tender epigastric pain and an otherwise normal exam. Then we get to the labs. He has a reactive leukocytosis, and Rima, I totally agree that this is probably not an infectious cause of his acute decompensation. His hemoglobin is a little low, which is abnormal for a young man, unless there is some other reason or unless this is potentially acute. Could this be an acute anemia causing a relative hypoxemia that goes along with it because he just doesn't have enough blood cells that are effectively carrying oxygen? And he has a lactic acidosis and a bicarb of 17. So this seems to be a metabolic acidosis. And in a patient who has this sort of profile, you know, we talked earlier about primary hyperaldosteronism and the fact that his potassium is normal makes me less concerned about that now. But in a patient who has this sort of metabolic profile and a background of uncontrolled hypertension and postprandial abdominal pain, I really feel like I want to narrow in on the vascular causes of abdominal pain and mesenteric ischemia. So what can cause mesenteric ischemia in a patient? What are some broad categories? And I might, Rima and Lizzie, let me invite you to kind of think about what actually happens in mesenteric ischemia, and then maybe think about a category of disease that can cause a patient to have decreased blood flow to their mesenteric vasculature. Maybe Rima, you could go first.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the most like acute and kind of scary one that comes to mind first would be something like a dissection.
Yeah, that's great. So in general, so an aortic dissection could cause decreased blood flow. And I think the pathophysiologic mechanism we're focusing in on in mesenteric ischemia is decreased blood flow to the mesenteric vasculature. And what are the mechanisms that can make that happen? And Rima, you brought up a great one of an aortic dissection. And in someone with uncontrolled systemic hypertension for, again, reasons we don't quite understand yet, but maybe aren't relevant at this point in someone who may have an emergency, that's definitely something I'd want to be concerned about and maybe rule out. Lizzie, what else do you think could cause a decreased perfusion to the mesenteric vasculature?
Well, classically, I think of mesenteric ischemia in patients who are older patients who have a lot of risk factors for atherosclerosis, so plaque buildup. And also thrombus is another one that I think of.
That's fantastic. I completely agree with that too. So patients with, again, going back to Rima's, a dissection that's causing a diversion of blood flow into a false lumen, therefore hypoperfusing the mesenteric vessels. We're talking about people who have atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease or a coagulopathy potential that could cause decreased blood flow to the mesenteric vessels. And I'd also want to include, in this being a young man, we talked about vasculitides briefly earlier on, and a patient with a vasculitis and you know, young patients especially, you know, we think about things like polyarteritis nodosa, Behçet's disease, potentially Takayasu's or IgA vasculitides. Those are some of the four more common vasculitic processes that can cause GI hypoperfusion. And in this patient, you know, we don't have any other sort of evidence of like rashes or ulcerations on their body that we were given that would make me think of a vasculitic process. So, you know, at this point, I feel like the things that I'd be concerned about within a vascular sort of process that could cause ischemia to the bowel, cause a elevated lactic acid, a decreased bicarbonate, and I didn't even mention the grossly elevated transaminases. That could potentially be from hyperperfusion too in the absence of viral hepatitis or other viral serologies or normal acetaminophen level. I'm concerned mostly about, could he potentially have a thrombus from a hypercoagulable disorder, or does he have a dissection potentially? And I feel like our workup could be focused from this point going forward to maybe elucidate a cause for mesenteric ischemia. And I know I'm throwing all my coins in one bucket at this point, so I'd love to pause and hear your guys' reflection on my thought process and let me know if I'm forgetting a category of disease.
No, I think that is wonderful. I think that's so makes so much sense. My one question is, you know, his having a normal creatinine, I guess we don't have a baseline creatinine, but I guess in a dissection, depending on where it is, perhaps he could potentially spare his kidneys. But I would maybe think that his kidney function would be affected as well. But again, we don't have a baseline. Maybe his baseline creatinine is 0.4 and he has a horrible AKI. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the only thing that I would really have to add in terms of me kind of thinking about the causes of mesenteric ischemia, like we were just saying, you know, classically we think about the atherosclerosis and the plaque buildup and things like that, but he is relatively on the younger side. And so I think thinking about his age in the context of kind of shaping our thought process and our differential could maybe help us as well. So maybe that atherosclerosis plaque buildup type of process hasn't had as much time to kind of go underway at his young age of 39. So that could potentially kind of promote thinking about things like dissection and or clot.
Your diagnostic acumen is very helpful, because ordering a CT scan is not just, you know, putting the order in the computer. You have to pick what type you want. And the protocol is different depending on what you're looking for. And so you guys were looking for an ischemic event or an aortic dissection, which is protocolized as a CT angiography, which is important, which is different than, you know, venography or a non-con CT. So we also got a CT angio, and it revealed a type B aortic dissection with basically pneumatosis from the patient's stomach to their hepatic flexure, for all intents and purposes, with portal venous gas, which is kind of curious that the lactate didn't really reflect the findings on the CT scan, and so a little non-congruence there, but nonetheless had a pretty substantial aortic dissection. The images are quite impressive, I gotta say. And so I had two problems going on, and I think you guys identified it kind of almost right off the bat.
This is amazing. What an amazing case.
And, you know, Patrick has some amazing teaching points prepared for us, and I really look forward to him sort of coalescing the findings of this case. So maybe we can open up to our amazing crew from UCSD. That was incredible. What are your reflections on going through this exercise? I open-ended question just to get your reflections out there before Dr. Murphy takes this case home.
Well, I can say that I've finally started breathing again. For the past 30 minutes, I've been holding my breath. So, oh, gosh. Rima, Lizzie, thank you. Woo!
Thank you.
Yeah, that was great. I think we did a great job. I think we really honed in on the on the uncontrolled hypertension. And I think it was beautiful. It was so fun.
Absolutely. No, I think it was a really fun kind of thought exercise to go through all of the different lab findings and kind of correlate that with the findings of ischemia. And then also just in general to kind of think about something like a dissection in the context of like a 1 month rather chronic process is a good learning point.
One thing that I'm learning is when I have nothing to add, to actually say I have nothing to add and then stop talking, which is really hard. So I'm going to say it. I have nothing to add. That was absolutely brilliant. And I think it really stands for itself. Pat, do you want to sort of summarize what you took away from this case?
Yes. So this was a pretty interesting case for me as a surgeon, because I operated on this patient. And, you know, with a type B dissection, there's really two ways to classify aortic dissections, the Stanford or DeBakey criteria, and they're both basically where it is relative to the three vessels that come off the aortic arch. So a type B is distal to the left subclavian, and really his dissection went down basically to the SMA and celiac, and so they had this false lumen that caused a lack of perfusion, and you have to wonder why a young person with a presumably healthy aorta could even get this problem, even if they were, you know, non-adherent to a medication profile. And that got us wondering about some underlying connective tissue disorder, although she doesn't really have the body habit, or he doesn't really have the body habitus for a connective tissue disorder that's classically described, but he is getting some genetic testing now to see if that was the cause. So with respect to the case resolution, given these findings on CT scan and the laboratory findings, you know, evidence of shock liver, I think, is pretty obvious at this point. The patient was actually taken for revascularization by interventional radiology first, where they fenestrated the dissection and put a graft from the true and false lumen to restore flow to the abdominal organs. And then we took him for a laparotomy for the ischemic enterocolitis the patient had. And really, there was evidence of necrosis from the third portion of the duodenum for about 100 centimeters. There was some necrosis, patchy necrosis of the stomach. The spleen was basically white.
Wow.
The liver had signs of ischemia. Wow. And the right colon and transverse colon had some patchy necrosis as well. The best thing going for this patient is, of course, it was diagnosed pretty quickly and that he was young. So he was actually very lucky in that, based on the CT scan, we thought everything was going to be dead, and only some of it was dead. So we resected all, pretty much all the dead things, and then brought him back for a second look, and ended up putting him back together. Fortunately or unfortunately, there was some ischemia of the pancreas at our second look, and so our anastomosis was sitting in pancreatic juice, but that turned out okay. Oof, in the end.
Wow.
And, of course, the patient was maintaining IV antihypertensives following revascularization and basically throughout his hospital stay. And so most of these aortic dissections present really suddenly with, you know, a tearing back pain you'll get on history. And it's associated with where the dissection is. So they'll get a tearing pain up in their chest if it's the dissection's kind of a type 1 or type 2 or Stanford type A dissection. Back pain's more associated with dissections that are distal to the subclavian in the abdomen. Stroke, paralysis, ischemia are all uncommon, but they also provide clues to the diagnosis, particularly in younger patients where this diagnosis is quite rare. Medical management is usually the treatment of choice for these, unless they have those complications. And so it's usually tight blood control with IV antihypertensives in the critical care unit. But when you have complications, you need prompt revascularization and then basically treatment of those complications. So a few takeaways from for clinical pearls. The degree of pneumatosis, and this is true in mesenteric ischemia, of which you guys really nailed the causes: thrombosis, embolic event, venous outflow obstruction, and non-occlusive mesenteric ischemia, which is basically just low blood pressure. Pneumatosis and even portal venous gas doesn't always correlate with the extent of the ischemia. In fact, some people, you operate on them for pneumatosis and they have no ischemia that's evident grossly. They might have microscopic ischemia, but you can't see that in the OR. And so you really need the combination of elevated lactate and pneumatosis to really say that's probably going to be ischemic when you actually go operate on the person. And then secondly, if there's any surgeons listening, planned second look operations are really the safe way to care for these patients, because you don't really know how much you're going to have to resect. So at our second operation, the spleen revascularized and was fine.
Wow.
Didn't have to come out. The stomach had kind of declared itself, and so a sleeve gastrectomy could be performed then, but it might have been able to be saved. The colon perked up and didn't have to be resected, so we just did the resection from the third portion of the duodenum to the jejunum. We actually ended up taking the gallbladder out because it had died in the interim. And this is true of any kind of mesenteric ischemias, unless it's really obvious and a defined segment that's dead. You usually bring them back for a second look to do your anastomosis and make sure nothing else has happened in the interim when you've resuscitated this patient in the ICU.
That was absolutely fantastic. Wow. Thank you so much.
That's a wrap, folks.